You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Let's walk the talk.
This is Clemens Manyathela
on 702.
So, former NPA head Bulelani Ngcuka has a new book. It's titled The Sting in the Tail. And it's a book that tells a story of his role in the anti-apartheid struggle, the price he had to pay, the harassment he was subjected to. It tells a story of his love story with the former deputy president, Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka, his interest in the law, and the inspiration from people like Mlungisi, Griffiths, Mxenge. And of course, it tells a story of his time as South Africa's first ever head of the NPA in that decision that he took not to criminally charge the then deputy president, Jacob Zuma. It's a decision that you could argue set in motion a process that saw a deputy president being dismissed, a president resigning, and the same deputy president elected president. And that all happened within the space of a few years. And when he took the job, he probably didn't know what was coming, but he'll tell us more about it. He's in studio with us. It's a job that later on would be described as a poisoned chalice. And I've got to tell you, one of the things I took for granted, right, is the work that went into building the NPA from scratch. I mean, you have prosecutors that were coming from the apartheid era. They had the skills, so you need them. You can't just fire them because they were serving that illegitimate regime. But how did you balance having them and having this new recruits and making sure that there was just one vision? Yeah? I mean, you had attorney general. That's the system that existed before. Like, each were completely independent of one another. So when I was reading in the book about how he began in really constructing and building the NPA from scratch, I realized how much of a big task that was. Mr. Ngcuka, thank you so much for making time. Welcome to 702.
Thank you very much, Clement. Thanks for having me, and good morning to your listeners.
Yeah, Chaingwe, is that your clan name, right?
Absolutely correct.
Got that in the book.
Yes.
How have you been? I was asking you earlier if, are you completely retired now? Are you still practicing law? What's happening now?
No, I'm not practicing law at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm working for an investment company called Vua.
Are you ever going to retire?
I hope to do that one day.
Okay. Yes. I want you to, first of all, tell me about the process of contributing to this book. It was written by Marion, but you contributed immensely. And I'm interested in, how did the process unfold? And are you satisfied with what's come out as the final copy?
Yes. You know, I had the privilege of working together with Marion. We were both in the Constitutional Assembly. And from the Constitutional Assembly, I worked with her in the NCOP. She became the CEO of the NCOP when I was the deputy chair. In fact, I am the one who hired her. And when I left the NCOP, she then joined me at the NPA and became the CEO of the NPA. And so she knew most of the things that I've been doing, and she really insisted and that she wanted to write a book about my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was resisting this all the time because to some people, they would have thought that I wanted to settle scores and, you know. But eventually, I decided, let's do it.
Yeah.
And so we worked on it for quite some time. We did a number of interviews. But the most difficult part of the book was editing.
Uh-huh.
After she had recorded this and then she put it into writing, and then we had to sit down together and work through it, rewrite it. And then Jonathan Ball, they brought in their own editor who then cut out quite a number of things, and they asked us to reduce. The book had run into about 600 pages.
What?
And they asked us to cut.
And you reduced it to like 390
or so. 350, now. Yeah. So we had to cut.
So I mentioned earlier that one of the things I really honestly took for granted is the work that you had to do in building the NPA from scratch. There was nothing. There was no phones. There was no furniture, you know, just empty offices. And you had to develop new structures and systems. So in the late 90s, when you are told you must be the first ever head of the NPA, what's going through your mind? And what was that process of just building this institution from scratch?
I really didn't know what I was in for, to be honest with you, Clement. And I didn't want the job, to be honest with you. When Dala first approached me, I said no. He then approached Zola Skweya, who was a very close friend of mine. Was at that time the Minister of Public Service and Administration. And Zola just came in and said, "Hey, Gwetin, why don't you take this job?" So I said, "No, I don't want this thing." And then they approached Saki Matkozo, a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And I still said no. But Dala didn't stop there. He then went to the deputy president, who called me and said, all of us have a responsibility to this country. Why is it, Wena, that you are refusing? When we give you a task to do, who should we give this task to? It's a responsibility for all of us.
And this is before the former president became, like, this is Thabo Mbeki, right?
He was still the deputy president. And of course, then I had no choice but to accept the job.
I mean, who says no to a deputy president or the president? When you're being called to be deployed, and really you believe in serving the public, right?
Exactly.
Now that you have come out, right, and even with the reservations that you had before you took up the job, Do you now realize why there are some people that even describe this job as a poisoned chalice? I think in the book, the job is described as it's filled with a deadly cocktail of multiple interests, race, business, social, socioeconomic, and the most fatal of them all, politics. So now that you've come out and you look at what you've gone through, what was the deadliest of them all? Was it politics? Was it socioeconomic? What was it really?
It was a combination of all those.
Mm.
You know, shortly after I had assumed office, the first decision that I had to take was whether to oppose the bail application of the Akenhoff Tree. And I did my investigation and I discovered that these guys were wrongly accused and they were in jail for wrong reasons. And I instructed the prosecutor then, who was doing the trial, not to oppose the bail application. Yo, the judge then in that case, he took me to the cleaners. He accused me of being an ANC lackey who was there to do an ANC bidding. And I was about to respond to him. I got a call from the president of the Constitutional Court at the time, was Arthur Charles Kassin, who just said to me, "Keep quiet, say nothing." And I was eager to respond. And later it turned out that, in fact, the very judge was accusing me was a member of the Puder Bond. And fortunately, those fellows were acquitted in the Supreme Court of Appeal, and I was vindicated in the decision that I took. And so I'm saying, I mean, from the very beginning, you knew that you are in this thing, and it's not going to be easy.
I mentioned that you also had to deal with, like, prosecutors who were in the apartheid regime, and I wonder because, and in the book you go into detail about whether or not some had intentions to probably expose this so-called black government and how incompetent it is, right? Because you can never know what their intentions are. How difficult was it to take the decision to keep the skills, right, of these prosecutors, some of whom were actually incredible at what they do, but also bring in the new recruits under this one vision of a new democratic South Africa?
Yeah. It was a very difficult one, Clement. I'll tell you one incident which will probably make you laugh. One of the attorneys general was a guy called Tim McNally from Natal. He was very unpopular in KZN and he had lost the confidence of the people there. And people believed that he, for example, had prosecuted the former Minister of Defense, Magnus Malan. He had done so for the sole reason that we should not prosecute them as the democratic government. And so he was very unpopular. So I inherited this. And I knew that for the prosecution to get the confidence of the people in KZN, I need to do something about McNally. But I didn't have grounds to fire him. And so I decided that I'm going to move him to Pretoria. And I'll invite him to come and work in my office. And in my interactions with him, I found him to be a very intelligent fellow and to be very constructive. But by then he had lost the confidence of the people in the province and I couldn't keep him there. And so I invited him to come to my office in Pretoria and work with me there. And when I consulted one of the people that I used to work with, George Bizos, all George said to me, Bulelani, please, don't keep a snake in your pocket. This is what I was trying to do to bring McNally. Unfortunately, Tim McNally didn't want to accept the proposal, and so I had to ask him to leave. But those were the things that I had to do. And some of the people, I mean, I've got a friend of mine, Connie Molus. You might probably know him. Connie was prosecuted by Jan Henning, one of the guys whom I promoted and made him one of my deputies. And Connie would say, oh, PT, man, of all the people, did you really have to take Jan Henning? And yet Jan Henning was the one who worked so hard, who helped me to turn the NPA around. And so those are the things that I had to deal with.
So it was a balancing act. On page 21 in the book, you actually go into detail about that. And you say, deep down, I believe there are some that wanted to prove at any cost that we were dealing with a corrupt black government and that I was there to protect this government. I had handpicked each of them because of their skills as investigators and prosecutors, but I had no illusions about their political loyalties. It would come as no surprise to me to learn that some of them celebrated each time they found a piece of evidence against Zuma or a government official. And speaking of Zuma, then in 2003, you are now confronted with this tough decision to whether to charge or not to charge the deputy president. And you have always said you don't regret taking that decision not to charge the former deputy president. And even in the book, you go into detail about how you really simply don't think there was a winnable case. Do you still believe that there's no winnable case against him, seeing that he's actually in court now? The NPA is trying to try him on the very same charges.
Well, you must distinguish between the time when I took the decision and now. Based on what I have seen, because the charges that have been preferred against the deputy the former president are different from those that would have been preferred to him if I had decided to charge him at the time. So I don't know what they have, but it would seem to me that they have more than what they had at the time when I was there. I still believe that at the time I took the right decision.
Yeah. What considerations did you make that led to the decision? Because in the book you say it was important to balance the interests and the prospects of success against the interests of the country.
Yes, absolutely so. You must remember, Clement, that when you prosecute the deputy president of the country, it's not like we are prosecuting just about anybody. And so you have to be very careful. You have to make sure that you have a case that you're going to win. If there's doubt, then don't do it. It's in the public interest that you don't plunge the country into chaos. Also remember that we had just come out of serious incidents of violence in KZN. And so it was important that you keep those things in mind and say, really? Should I do it? What are the implications of my decision? It weighs very, very heavily on one's mind. And so, yes, as they say, if you want to shoot at the king, make sure you don't miss.
But here's the trouble for me. And as I was reading the book, trying to understand the decision you took, and I thought, but you've got an investigating team that's recommending to you that a criminal prosecution be instituted against the deputy president. I mean, surely they were confident that they had a strong case and they weighed those prospects of success. And that's why you had to say, even when you were announcing that Zuma won't be charged, you said there's prima facie evidence, but we are not going to charge. That's the most confusing thing ever. If there's prima facie evidence, why are you not allowing the courts to decide on the merits of the case?
No. Prima facie does not mean sufficient.
Mm.
It says on the face of it, there's a case against him. Indeed, there was a case against him on the face of it. However, we're not satisfied that we had sufficient evidence for us to get a conviction. So the test is different.
What evidence did you need? Because Shabir Sheikh was charged.
All the evidence we had against the deputy president was circumstantial. It was based on correspondence that was written by other people about him, not by himself.
Mm.
And so it may well be that he could come to court and explain, you know, and say, no, I know nothing about it.
And that's precisely the point. Why did we not allow the courts to go through the merits of the case so that he can explain and that circumstantial evidence can be tested in court?
Yes. You see, you must go to court when you know that you'll be able to get a conviction. And the conviction at that time is based on there must be proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm.
Once I had doubt, then that decision is mine. It's not for the court to make. The court pronounces whether the person is guilty or not guilty. I must decide whether to put the charges or not. And that decision is mine. It's not for the court.
Did that put you at odds with your investigators? Because they seem to be confident that there's a case here. So when you decided, yes, I get that there's prima facie. In fact, in the book, you mentioned that one of the prosecutors threatened to resign if you don't stipulate that there's prima facie evidence. Did that put you at odds? And I mean, after you made that decision, what happened in the team?
No, actually, it's very interesting. They never threatened. They never threatened. I was always transparent with my team. And up to today, I still enjoy their confidence. Up to today. And when we took that decision, I explained to them, and let me just backtrack a little bit. I also appointed another team, which was a bit distant from them, because these were the investigators were a little bit subjective.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to bring a bit of objectivity into this. I appointed another team, senior advocates, who looked at the evidence dispassionately and came to the same conclusion as me. And I went further. I engaged the services of a senior counsel from the bar. Very, very top counsel. I said, this is the decision that I have to take. Have a look at this evidence and tell me what you think. He came to the same conclusion as me. And so we went back to the team and said, this is what we are doing. They said, thank you, boss. We support you. We like the fact that you are able to say, this is what we have done. And we like that. And then Kharda said, if you had not said so, which goes back to those people who think that all the time.
Mm.
If you had not said this, boss, I would have resigned.
Mm.
Because people would have thought that I'm part of a cover-up.
Mm.
I said, no, there is no cover-up. Feel free.
Yeah.
Engage. As I say to you today, I mean, I still engage with them and they still have confidence in me.
Mm. I want to ask you, before we go to the latest in Eyewitness News headlines, about the considerations that had to be made. Because on page 3, you say, and I quote, when considering whether to prosecute a deputy president for corruption, you cannot approach it as though it is just any other case. My decision could have had serious implications for the country, for our political stability and the economy, and the public interest had to be taken into account. And one of the things I was asking myself is whether, you know, should there be political and economic considerations when deciding on whether or not to charge someone for a criminal act? And I'm asking that because lately, when the former president was actually sentenced to jail by the Constitutional Court, I was introduced to this Latin legal phrase, fiat justitia rua silam, meaning let justice be done though the heavens fall. So yes. The maxim signifies the belief that justice must be realized regardless, even though the heavens fall. Do you not agree with that principle?
Absolutely agree. I have no problems with that.
So because in other words, even if the consideration was that there would be political violence, I mean, that consideration must not matter in the bigger interest of there being justice.
That's correct.
Mm.
You must remember And this bear in mind, you must first have sufficient evidence. Okay? If you have sufficient evidence, whatever it is, you then prosecute. But if you don't, where you have doubt, then all these other considerations come into mind. Must you take the risk? All right? What then happens? You understand? That is the problem.
It's just after 10:30. Bulelani Ngcuka in conversation with us. The book is called The Sting in the Tail. I couldn't put it down. I tell you, you want to read it. I want us to still talk about, we'll touch on the spy tapes, we'll touch on the critical institutions that he managed to set up at the NPA. We'll touch on the TRC, because at some point he put together a team to look at some of these TRC cases. So all of that coming up in the second half hour. I'll take your questions as well. You can give us a call or send us WhatsApp voice notes on 072-702-1702.
702.
The Clemens Maniatella Show.
Let's walk the talk.
It's 24 minutes before 11 o'clock. The Sting in the Book is the book by Bulelani. The Sting in the Tail, I should say, is the book by Bulelani Ngcuka. Finished reading it last week. Fascinating. Detail, not just about his role in the NPA, in the decisions that he took and the issues that he was confronted with, but also just generally about his journey with the anti-apartheid struggle. We've spoken about that big controversial decision, and I want to maybe let me put two questions to him from you guys on 011-883-0702, the WhatsApp line as well, and then I'm going to get into the politics, the spy tapes, the TRC, and the other issues quickly. Mr. Ngcuka on Twitter says, Clement, interesting take on circumstantial evidence by Mr. Ngcuka. A question for me is, does he think that the Zondo Commission is a big circumstantial evidence fest that might not actually help the NPA? Because it's all about statements of he said, she said.
Very interesting question. No. Yes and no. There are instances where there has been direct evidence, which I think the NPA can act on. And there are other instances where the NPA must conduct further investigation so that they can make the case trial ready. It's not ready as it is now coming out of the Zondo Commission. So they need to finalize some of those investigations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I want us to talk about the politics, because when I mentioned that this position was a poison chalice, and the way it's described in the book is that the most fatal of them all is politics. You took an oath to prosecute cases without fear or favor, but the reality is that, I mean, you were a politician yourself, and the people who appointed you were your comrades. And I often wondered, and I kept on asking myself, whether it was a good decision to appoint a politician, an anti-apartheid activist, to such a position that requires the highest level of independence. And this is not so much just on you as the person who is occupying that position, but it says something about the people around you as well. So, one, was it difficult for you to be independent in the face of even investigations and decisions to prosecute even the people you were in prison with, the people you are close comrades with? And what was the pressure like coming from them when you were looking at some of their cases and they were being investigated by the Scorpions?
Thank you. On whether you should appoint politicians or not, let me say this. I'm a lawyer first. I was trained as a lawyer and I practiced as such. That's what comes first. And that was the reason why I was appointed to the position. Because I'm legally qualified for the position. Secondly, you know this thing about being a politician, now it sounds as if it's just a swear word.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas during our time, and I would hope that it will continue, because you find it difficult now to attract good people to go into politics, because politics is sort of associated with corruption, which is not the case. We went into politics not because it's what we wanted to do. We were compelled to go there by the circumstances, because we were the fighters, the liberators of this country. That's why we ended up there. And so we were driven. We were driven by our commitment to social justice, to freedom and equality by this country. And those are the hallmarks of our politicians at the time. It might be different now, because what you see in that parliament is a sad story. But during our time, that was not what motivated us. You know, we were driven there by the higher calling.
Yeah.
That's who we were. And so there have been nothing wrong to appoint a person in my position to be the NTPP.
Did you feel conflicted, though? Because I do agree with you, and I had a chat with Sinazo, the producer, about this in the morning, who also feels, you know, at the time, I mean, look at Piers Langa, there are other people, George Bezos, there are other people who even ended up in the Constitutional Court, Albie Sachs. These are people that were in the anti-apartheid struggle. So do you then say, ooh, let's not appoint them, even though they are legally qualified, because they are against this unjust system? So I absolutely get that point. But I guess what I'm asking is, did you at some point feel conflicted? Because, and I want to read you a little bit from page 16. When you were told, when you got a call, I think you were in the Eastern Cape, you got a call from one of the prosecutors who said, hey, we've got evidence against Zuma. And your reaction was that, I felt, of a comrade who's worried about the other comrade, worried about the political party. You were concerned about how you were going to manage the political fallout. Because you said, when I got that call, my heart sank. I asked what this evidence was, and she told me about the famous encrypted facts. What is this going to do to the ANC? What will this do to the government? What will this do to South Africa? What will this do to the Scorpions? All these arguments were running through my head. That essentially was the end of my holiday. So when I was reading it, I was like, hence I'm asking about whether or not you felt you were conflicted. So when you're hearing about Zuma, you know Zuma is a comrade. At the time, did you not at any point feel that you are conflicted to even make a judgment call about whether or not he faces justice?
Oh, no, not at all. I was not conflicted. There was nothing personal for me in this. And so the critical thing for me was to make sure that I do the right thing all the time. And so, no, it never came into it. Of course, one felt the pressure. Of course, lots of people called me and spoke to me. No, don't do this. No, do this. Everybody had an opinion, which I discarded, you know. And it did not only relate to Deputy President Zuma. I mean, for example, you can take the case of Brett Kaplan.
Yeah.
Lots of people came to me and said, please, I'm an umlungwe to Luna, you know.
Yeah. He was close to, was it the ANC
you
think at the time?
I was doing the case of Ivan Khoza, for example. And people will come and talk to me about it and say, leave Ivan alone. Actually, there was a very interesting incident at the funeral of Governor Mbeki. I was walking ahead, and unbeknown to me, Ivan was walking behind me, going to the graveyard in KwaZakhele, and I heard people shouting there in the streets, leave Ivan alone, you know. And he was behind me, and he said, please, I didn't set these people up to do this to you. So these were the experiences that went through. But those things happened.
And with Tony Engeni, did you feel
same
any
thing.
Pressure?
It was the same thing. I mean, Tony even went to the extent of accusing me of being weak and said there was going to be blood on the floor and everything else. I mean, lots of other comrades would call me from Parliament and say, please, drop the case, you know.
But you went to a meeting. Who was the Justice Minister at the time?
Maduna.
Is it Maduna?
Yes.
You went to, Maduna called you to his house. You get there and you find Tony Engeni. And I felt at that point you walk away as the head of the NPA, because here's someone in the house whom the Scorpions are investigating, that you have to decide on whether or not we're going with the prosecution, and he's in the house and he wants to put up a case to you. Did you not feel that Maduna put you in a compromising position where you have to meet in a private space with someone who is facing corruption charges and they're putting up a case before you?
You know what I did when I got there, I wasn't aware that Tony was going to be in that meeting. So I was shocked to find him there. But nevertheless, you see, our position is very simple, Clement. If you want to make representations to the NPA, we've got an office that deals with representations. Mm. Make them. In that meeting there, I said to them, I said to Tony, and I said to Maduna as well, I can't talk to you, Tony. You're an accused person. I can't talk to you. I'm willing to talk to your lawyers. Go and make arrangements. Let your lawyers come and talk to me. Because whatever you say may be held against you. So I can't talk to an accused person. That's what happened.
But Maduna, what did you say to him? Because that was a compromising position. At the very least, you should have at least said to you that, hey, come over here, just note that Tony Yengeni is here.
Yeah, probably should have. He probably should have said that, that look, man, these people want to talk to you, let's do this. I would have told him the same thing, that no, tell them that I can't talk to an accused person, I will talk to his lawyers, which is what happened.
Hmm. I want to talk a little bit now about the critical institution that you set up in the NPA, the Scorpions. It was the NPA's Directorate of Special Operations. It was this independent multidisciplinary agency that investigated and prosecuted organized crime and corruption. Going through the book, and I see how many successful prosecutions were there. Really, you know, the criminal underworld was genuinely afraid of the Scorpions. And I sometimes feel like that's what we need now. Just let's talk about how that was established and how it was able to be such a threat to the criminals. And please compare that to what we have today. I think what's closest to that now is what, the investigative directorate?
Yes, yes, yes. You know, I must say this. I was fortunate at the time in that I had people who were willing to work with us and went out of their way to assist us. In the form of Ayadala, who was the Minister of Justice, Zola Skweyiya was the Minister of Public Safety and Administration, Steve Chwete, Minister of Police, John Tlantla was the Minister of Intelligence.
Mm.
All those comrades was very close to, and it was easy to work with them. And they went out of their way to make sure that we're able to create this institution and make it work.
Hmm.
So that was very important. There was a political will behind the formation of the Scorpions. And also I must not forget that George Fivers was the National Commissioner of the Police at the time. He really helped. He helped us in creating the Scorpions. One of the things that I quickly discovered was that when I was working with the investigating directorates, I had people seconded to us, right? They were seconded to us, and they were not employed by us. And so they had to report back to the police or to the intelligence, wherever they came from, which was something that was an inhibition. And so what we did was to make sure that we had our own investigators. We trained them. And we wanted to set them apart. Hence, I managed to persuade the FBI to train them and Scotland Yard to train our people.
Yeah.
So I had them trained by the FBI, trained by Scotland Yard, and then they came back and worked with us, and they were reporting to us.
Mm.
And secondly, what we did was to make sure that people work as teams so that you can't just influence one person.
Mm.
I think the difficulties that the guys are having now is that they don't have their own investigators. So the investigative directorate relies on people coming from other institutions who don't work for them.
But why isn't that capacity created?
That's what needs to be done. It needs to be done, and I hope it will be done.
All right. I'm going to take a quick head break. When we come back, Cindy Le in Kagiso Kgotso in Midrand, I see your calls. I'll come to you shortly.
You're with Clement Maniatella.
702.
All right, it's 9 minutes before 10 o'clock, and before I go to Cindy Len Kgotso, I want to ask you, the investigative directorate, though, because they don't even have that capacity that the Scorpions have, do you think they can take on even these complex state capture cases?
Oh, yes, yes, they can. I mean, it does not mean... when we started, of course, we also used the police at the time and worked directly with them. No, they can. They can do that.
Cindy Len, you're in Kagiso. Hi.
Hello, Clement. Let me quickly ask the question. I just want to know, because I'm asking this question on a basis of conflict of interest. Have we ever been a friend of Jacob Zuma or share meal, dinner, or work together in the ANC, or sit down with Jacob Zuma, visit each other? I just want to know that, because he was supposed to prosecute Jacob Zuma and he didn't, and I believe he was in the ANC. So I just want to know his relationship with Jacob Zuma.
All right. Sendile, I've got it. Did you have any kind of relationship with him?
Other than that, all, both of us, we belong to the ANC and we worked in the ANC. No.
Yeah, in the book you do mention, though, that you went to his official residence.
Yes.
To talk to him about these charges and how this is a matter that has to be completed. Is that the normal process you follow as the head of the NPA, to go to someone you and explain to them about the case against them?
The matter had already been in the news.
Mm.
It had been leaked, not by us, by the way. It had been leaked. It was all over the news. And so I thought that it was important that I tell him.
Hmm.
Because at the end of the day, he was the deputy president and he sits in some of these cabinet committees with all these ministers and everybody else. So I felt it's important that I tell him what's happening.
Kotso?
Which is what I did.
Yeah. Kotso in Midrand, hi.
Hi, morning, Clement, and how are you?
Go ahead, sure.
Look, man, quickly. You are sitting with a man who benefited from the previous regime, is still benefiting from the legacies of democracy, handsomely so. Number one, first question which I want him to deal with is the issue of the NPA. Look, NPA, as far as I'm concerned, I'm a scholar. So before he's going to answer, I just want to put...
Yeah, just quickly, Kotso, because we're out of time.
No, I'm coming.
Quickly, come,
NPA,
Baba.
NPA, number one, is no longer relevant.
Yeah.
To the current dispensation. Number two is about the judiciary.
Yeah.
What is his comment about the judiciary, whereby you can sit here as a layman and be able to second judge a court outcome, more especially of the High Court?
Okay, Kotso and Midrand, got you. So Kotso wants to know of your view of the state of the NPA currently, and Kotso wants to know about the judiciary as well, because he thinks he can second judge the justices sitting at the Constitutional Court.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, the NPA, it's very, very relevant. It will continue to be relevant. It's a very, very important institution. I think it behoves all of us to make sure that we support the NPA in its task, to make sure that it succeeds. That's number one. Number two, the judiciary is very, very important in our society. And I don't believe what he believes in, that you can second guess the judges. I don't think so.
So I want to touch a little bit then on, okay, let me take this question maybe from Clive first, and then I'll ask mine. Clive in Limbro Park. Hi, Clement. What a legend that you have in studio there. Please, can you ask him what his take is about the current allegations on the current president regarding the farm? Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I work on evidence. I have not seen any evidence at this stage. I've seen the allegations. And so since the matter is being investigated, I would rather not say anything until the investigation has been completed.
But do you think the matter has been handled properly? In other words, I mean, could the president have handled differently and maybe become more transparent and say, this is what happened, and this is what I'm actually going to tell the police as they investigate? Because if it's the truth, then the story is never really going to change.
Well, it's very different, Clement, when you are dealing with an investigation. Because the allegations now, they've been given to the police and the police have been asked to investigate a criminal case against the president. And so as his lawyer, if I was his lawyer, my advice to him would have been, keep quiet. Wait until the investigation is done. And that would have been my advice to him.
Even as a head of state who has always preached transparency?
You have rights. You have rights as a citizen of this country.
Hmm.
You must use those rights.
Yeah.
If people say, these are allegations against you, we want, there's a case of corruption, there's a case of money laundering, and whatever that is being investigated against you, then you can only comment when you know what evidence there is against you.
Okay.
You wait.
Two last issues. One is about the spy tapes. Mokote Dimshe was appointed acting NDPP following Vusi Pikoli's dismissal. And then in 2009, he took a decision to withdraw the charges against Zuma, citing the head of the Scorpions, Leonard McCarthy, had abused the legal processes. So he argued there was political interference. And you were involved because they brought the conversation you had with Leonard McCarthy. Do you think you somehow was interfering as a former NPA head, having a conversation with the head of the Scorpions about how they were going to go about doing their work? In this case, arresting the former president or charging him, I should say.
No, Clement. I mean, that was absolute rubbish. Two things. I'll be very brief about it. Leonard was away on leave when the decision was taken by Mshe to charge Zuma before the conference.
The ANC conference, yes. Yeah.
Mshe took that decision. He then went to report to Bridget Mabandla, who was the Minister of Justice. And Bridget told him that you are mad. You can't do that at this time. You are going to plunge the country into bloodshed. Mshe came back and reported to Billy Downer and them that he has decided not to charge before the conference. Leonard is away on leave. Billy Downer puts this in writing and complains and sends this letter to Leonard and asks Leonard to convince Mshe to change that decision. Puts it in writing. Leonard is away. He comes back. Decision is taken. He calls me later, well knowing that nothing of the sort is going to happen. They're not going to charge because Mshe has taken the decision.
Yeah.
It was just nothing else except but me, I responded to him in all honesty. I said, Leonard, you can't do that. You'll be mad to do so. Indeed. It was wrong. It would have been very stupid of them to go and charge Zuma when he was standing for the presidency of the ANC. And you know that if you arrest him, you're going to affect the outcome of that conference.
But was it right for Leonard to be sharing that information with you?
There was nothing wrong with it.
What, were you talking as friends or?
Yes, but also you must remember this. Even on that case, Zuma had continued to drag me in. I had signed an affidavit in that case at the time. So I was an interested party in the matter.
But do you think Leonard should have shared that crucial information?
Of course, because I'm the one who had to sign affidavits.
But you were no longer the head of the NPA.
But you see, Zuma had dragged me on into the case. And so I was an interested party. Because you see, even now, the case that was before court, I've had to depose to another affidavit in that matter. And therefore, because I'm a party to it, it's of interest to me what is happening with the affidavit that I've submitted.
Who do you think leaked those tapes and was listening to your conversations?
It was Fraser.
Arthur Fraser?
Yes, Arthur Fraser. It's the same Arthur Fraser. He has always been a lawyer.
He's been denying it.
No, it was him. We know that.
Yeah. Given what he's done then, do you think he may have used the position he had and the access he has as the then head of the State Security Agency to find information in this case to go after the current president?
Well, I don't want to speculate, but I suspect so. I don't want to speculate because I don't have the facts before me. But that is my suspicion, really.
All right. If you will indulge me, please, I want you to answer the last question about the TRC, but I'm going to ask it to you after the latest in Eyewitness News. I've asked Bulelani Ngcuka to stay in for just 3 minutes because I want him to answer a question I have about the TRC, and I'm going to go straight into it, and then we'll take a break and start with our World of Work feature. Mr. Ngcuka, I appreciate you agreeing to be here for another 2 minutes, just so we wrap this up. Before we went to the news, you spoke about Arthur Fraser as the one who leaked those spy tapes. He did so illegally. So why wasn't he charged and investigated?
Well, it was fairly obvious. I mean, I had complained and I had asked them to investigate this matter. And it was fairly obvious that he did this in order to protect the then President Zuma. So there was going to be no investigation.
Do you think he was protected?
Of course.
By the former president?
Of course he was. All those, I mean, it would have, if Fraser had been prosecuted, it would have exposed Mshe that he had done something wrong. So it was in their interest that the matter be killed.
So there's a listener who, Kabelo, on Twitter says, Clement, please can you ask Bulelani, did Ranjeni Mhlontsami and Mo Sheikh ever apologize for wrongly labeling him a spy, and it was around 2003, right? Yes, if I'm not mistaken. When, so. In fact, it wasn't just Mo Sheikh, it was Mark Maharaj as well, who claimed that you were a spy. And yes, finally, there was an inquiry into the allegations, and both of them ended up saying, actually, we don't have evidence to that effect. Have they ever apologized to you?
Mo did.
Mark Maharaj?
Mark never did.
Really?
Maharaj never did.
Did that affect your relationship? Because you guys were comrades.
I never had any relationship with Maharaj.
And he never called you to say, I'm sorry about it?
No.
And Ranjeni Munsami?
No.
Because the story was leaked to her. And she, Sunday Times said, we're not covering it. And she sent it to the City Press.
The City Press, that's correct.
She has not apologized.
No.
Okay. The TRC, the failure of the NPA to prosecute the TRC-related crimes remains a sore point for not just South Africans, but the many families and struggle activists who died at the hands of the apartheid security forces. And I know shortly after your appointment, you set up a working group. It was led by Vincent Saldana.
Yes.
And that was to review all the cases that had been refused amnesty by the TRC. And I think the first TRC-related matter the unit prosecuted was that of Eugene Terre-Blanche. And I wonder, when you look back now, where were the failures? Was there political interference that led to most of these TRC cases not being taken up and investigated and successfully prosecuted by the NPA?
At the time, I mean, when I left, there had been no interference whatsoever. And my instructions were very clear to the guys. Where there's evidence, you must prosecute. And they were, one of the cases that they were going to prosecute was that of Nivot in Port Elizabeth, which I approved. So some of the cases, the investigation was still ongoing when I left in 2004. Subsequently to that, I heard, I heard through the media that there was an instruction that was given to Vusi and them that they must hold on with the prosecution of the TRC cases, and that and that those matters were under review. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen during my time.
So it's so interesting. Why would those matters be under review? And I'm asking you this understanding, well, after reading the book, the role you played, even in, you know, the discussions before the national elections, etc. A lot of South Africans often think, was there a secret deal between the ANC and the National Party not to go after these TRC cases? Because how else do you explain why 27 years later there's still no proper, sufficient accountability emanating from the outcome of the TRC? In fact, the commissioners had to write to President Cyril Ramaphosa a couple of years ago asking why government is failing to implement the recommendations of the commission. Is there any credence to some sort of a secret deal that may have occurred between the ANC and the National Party?
No, there was no secret deal. I was party to those negotiations. I remember the police came to our subcommittee on the eve of us agreeing the interim constitution to the effect that they wanted a blanket amnesty for whatever they did and that the violence would continue if they don't get that blanket amnesty. We refused. It was then that we came with this notion of setting up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and that it was not up to us. We could not take away the rights of citizens who had been wrongly affected from them taking whoever to court. We couldn't do that. And so we set up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So there was no secret deal.
Yeah,
I know that.
So this is just the ANC really failing to take that issue seriously and recommending the and implementing the recommendations.
I don't know why, because there is no law. There is no law that says don't prosecute those people. All those people who were not granted amnesty by the TRC, they should be prosecuted. And there is no law that says don't do it.
Yeah.
And I think it's up to the NPA. I think part of the problem is that the NPA over the last 10 years or so has itself been captured.
Bulelani Ngcuka, thank you so much for making time and thanks for agreeing to stay for a couple of more minutes. Bulelani Ngcuka, The Sting in the Tail is the name of the book. You want to get your hands on it. I couldn't put it down. It's really, really fascinating.